Welcome to the Science Line. I'm Scott.
And I'm Risa. We're here to learn about the science that's happening here in our Idaho community, but we're also challenging scientists who dare to come on our show to think about how they communicate their research to people who know nothing about it, but whose tax dollars are funding it, like us.
But we're not going to take it easy on our guests. They will have to pay for their communication faux pas, like using ridiculous and unrelatable science terms and jargon, and they better not bore us. Based on how well they do, we'll assign them written homework in the form of lines. Hopefully, this will remind them of their blunders and what not to do next time.
Geez, take it easy, Scott. No one's going to want to come on our show if you keep carrying on like that.
Risa, we've made it to episode 9 of The Science Line.
I know, it's great. And thanks to KISU and Jamin Anderson for keeping us around, Especially you, Scott.
They've been good to us. And I think we should also thank all of our guests who have been happy to put up with our antics.
For sure.
So how are we going to kick off the show this week?
Well, in a bit of a tangent from our regular science communication topics, I would like to talk about gender discrimination in science.
Gender discrimination? So is that the same as sexism?
Well, some could argue that there are subtle differences, but for the most part, gender discrimination and sexism are the same thing. The unequal treatment of someone based on that person's sex.
Yeah, so I guess sadly, gender discrimination exists all around us. And we do still hear about it in academia and science.
Yeah, we do. But articulating what constitutes gender inequality in science is not simple. There are a number of metrics we can attempt to look at to measure gender inequalities. For instance, pay disparities, imbalance in leadership positions, disparities in career longevity and success, but other times it's not so clear.
So to be clear here, are we talking about discrimination against women?
Yeah, historically women have been excluded and undervalued in science, and even now gender discrimination against women still exists.
So I'm getting the feeling that you're about to tell me about a study that you've read.
You know it. So last year, a study was published in the National Academy of Sciences. This was a huge study of 1.5 million academics, and it examined how gender correlates with productivity and impact of an academic career. Unsurprisingly, the study found that women have been increasingly involved in science since 1955. Mm-hmm. Also, the study found that men and women publish a comparable number of papers per year and have equivalent career-wise impact for the same total number of publications.
Well, hold on a minute. Doesn't that mean that gender discrimination isn't a big problem anymore?
This is why I started off by saying that it's difficult to define gender discrimination at times. The same study also found that women have shorter academic careers and drop out at much higher rates.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it's a much more subtle distinction. The study found that women are more likely to drop out or have shorter careers.
That's correct. And so overall, the authors of this paper are suggesting that an updated understanding of gender inequality in academia can help rephrase the conversation around the sustainability of women's careers in academia.
Risa and I are pleased to be joined in the studio by Dr. Mona Xu, Associate Professor of Experimental Psychology here at Idaho State University.
Hey, Mona. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And congratulations for winning one of the 2021 Outstanding Teacher Awards this year at ISU.
Thank you.
That's awesome. We are so happy for you.
That's really good. Risa, why didn't you win one?
Oh, thanks, Scott. I know.
Next year.
So Scott and I have been discussing gender discrimination in science, and we are really excited to talk to you about this topic because are we correct in thinking that you recently wrote a rebuttal letter to a controversial and potentially sexist study that was published in a highly reputable scientific journal, Nature Communications?
Yes, that's correct. So there were 10 of us who put together a preprint, which is available online in rebuttal to that article, which thankfully has been retracted.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about the article and what inspired your rebuttal?
Sure. So this is an article that got a lot of attention online. Essentially, what they were looking at was co-authorship, but what they were stating was that they were looking at mentorship and gender, which gender they defined binarily and calculated based on an algorithm of assigning first names to either male or female, which is very problematic.
Yeah. But you have a name like Leslie or something like that, which is used by both genders.
And actually for this show, just for fun, I ran both your names through that algorithm.
Oh.
So Scott, they said male, and it was like 99% probability that was correct. Mm-hmm. Risa, it was male, and it was 53% probability that was correct.
Oh, wow, that's so interesting.
So if you had been in the database for their study, you would have been removed from the database because they had a cutoff of it had to be at least 90%. And so while their paper said they looked at a database of 215 million names, it isn't until you go into their supplemental material that they admit that they had to drop more than half of the people in there because they couldn't reach that quality level.
So this study basically said that women who were co-authoring should co-author with men if they wanted to be more successful?
Yes. So basically they were saying, if you're a woman, find a male mentor. And if you're a woman mentoring, only mentor males, or mentor males more because mentoring women is going to be bad for your career. And mentorship, they were defining as citations and how impactful you are. That was their quality mentor definition, which is super problematic, right? We mentor for many reasons outside of publication. And even the way they defined who a mentor was, as long as you were on a paper with someone else, so as long as the paper had 20 or fewer authors, let's say you were 7 or fewer years into your career, anyone above that 7-year mark would be your mentor as long as they were on the paper in your discipline and also in your U.S.-based institution.
Oh, so did you have a problem then with the methodology of the study, or was it actually to do with some of the content as well, some of the suggestions that they were making?
Yeah, so it was both. So our rebuttal included both, like, hey, these are terrible definitions, the way you did your methodology, right? So if you were on a paper with someone you've never talked to, they would still count you as a mentor as long as you met those criteria. But also, it's a cross-sectional study with no sense of evidence for causality, but they're making causal claims, and they're actually making suggestions for policy change and what people should do in terms of, hey, you know, encourage people to work with women less, right?
Rather than address the actual issue of gender discrimination that seems to be being discussed. It's just like, don't worry about that, just work with men.
Right. And one of the interesting things about Nature Communications is they actually publish their review process. So you can go through and see what the reviewers were saying.
Right.
And the reviewers are calling them out about, hey, including shouty caps of like, you can't say causality. And it keeps getting through. One of the reviewers, Daniel Acuna, reviewed non-blinded. And afterwards on Twitter, he came out to say, like, I thought it was going to be desk rejected. I thought it was going to be rejected every level, and it didn't.
Yeah, I saw that. That was really interesting.
Wow. So was the paper retracted following your rebuttal?
So it went on notice that they were going to do an investigation almost immediately. We put out our preprint in 4 days. It was the fastest writing I've ever done. I think mostly because we were just so, like, someone has to say something. This is so potentially damaging.
Yes.
Right? And I know there were many other rebuttals as well, either preprints or on social media or more formally, some of which have been published. And after the investigation, they decided to pull the paper and publish a little report of the investigation.
Wow. So based on this, going sort of to the broader question, I mean, clearly from this paper, there's some major issues. But do you believe that gender discrimination still exists in academia? And what are the barriers that need to be overcome?
Yeah, so absolutely, it still exists. And the barriers are many across, individual level things as well as very system level things. And so when we think about solutions, it has to be kind of across the board, not just, you know, a workshop here or there, but we want to think about, you know, who is succeeding, quote unquote, what we count as success, right? So this paper really highlights, for example, in science, citations is something that really counts. But when you talk about mentorship, there's plenty of other things that are important. And for many people, you know, publication is not why they got into what they're doing, or being a big hub person. So that's words from that article is not why they got into science. Thinking about, you know, who our leaders are in science, both in terms of the gatekeepers, who are the editors of journals, who are people on panels and keynotes at conferences. but also media. So, and you're helping to fix this a little bit. Who are we going to, right? Who do we ask? Is it always the same people and a very homogenous group of people that we ask, that we consider to be the experts, right? Mm-hmm. In which case it becomes a very narrow sense of what success looks like, when in fact success in science in terms of novel breakthroughs, in terms of bridging fields, that looks very different than just who gets invited for, you know, the one big talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, it sounds like you've done the scientific community a bit of a service, so we should thank you. And it obviously demonstrates the need for even the most respected journals to be subjected to this scientific community, and we're able to sort of keep each other in check almost. So I think that's really, really great. But we should probably move on, right? Because otherwise we're going to run out of time just talking about this all day.
That's exactly right. And we for sure have to ask every one of our guests whether or not you were well-behaved in school and if you ever had to write lines on the board.
I was fairly well-behaved in school. I did not have to write lines in school, but I don't think I went to a school where that was a common practice.
Oh, did you ever have any other kind of punishment for
misbehaving?
Misbehaving?
So I do remember, I was born in China. I moved to the U.S. when I was 5. And I do remember being told that when I was in, I think, the equivalent of kindergarten, they had a call my family because I was being a little bit of a smart mouth. And maybe this is the beginning of my scientific inquiry. So the teacher had told us all to like put our heads down on the table and not move and just, you know, kind of chill out. And I apparently was raising my hand to be like, you know, can we blink? Like, what's the, what are the boundaries of this request?
That's hilarious. That's really cute.
That is funny.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and of course, the reason we like to ask that is because here at the Science Line, at the end of the show, we love to dish out lines. So depending on how well you do on the show today, we'll decide how many lines to give you. So if you're really good at communicating your science, you don't get very many lines. If we think we don't understand what you're on about at all, then you get loads of lines.
That's right. And we understand that some of your research is about romantic love, which we are very interested in hearing about today. And so with that in mind, your line, which you're going to need to try and recall at the end of the show, is I will convince the listeners to swipe right on the science line.
Oh, okay.
Does that mean anything to you, to swipe right?
Yes. Okay. I have not done that myself, but I've read much research about that. So.
Very good.
Well, perfect. That's perfect line.
Exactly. We worried that we were being sort of too hip and hop, you know, with the swipe right.
But I told Scott that I had heard of it. And so I was like, if I have.
Yes. Yeah, it's probably an old thing now. I'm not sure what the newest
newest thing is.
We're probably out of date. But yeah, for any of our listeners that don't know, the swiping right is obviously on a popular dating app. And it's sort of, you see someone and then you just swipe them and then you get to talk to them, I think. I don't know.
I think if you match, right, if they also swipe right on you.
Oh, so you both have to swipe
there
right.
There you go.
Okay, fair enough.
So listeners, swipe right on us too.
We are moving on, Mona, to the Why Do We Care segment. And this is when we give you approximately 2 minutes to explain to us and our listeners what you do as a scientist and why we should care. And we are expecting to hear a little bit about your studies in romantic love.
So as context, I run the Thor Lab at ISU, which is Teaching Health and Optimal Relationships. I'm very happy about that acronym. It matches the Professor X kind of identity I sometimes have. So some of my research is on teaching and mentoring, which is why that paper was such a big deal. But the main things we'll probably talk about today are my research on health and romantic relationships. And these are so important because they impact our well-being, our mental health. They focus on behavioral things, so physical activity, smoking, eating. And then relationships-wise, a lot of what I've done has been on romantic love, looking at it with both neuroimaging methodology as well as self-report, and also cross-culturally, so in different countries and across different cultures. And the reason why relationships are so important, and I think this past year has really highlighted that even more, is it's so beneficial for our well-being to have strong relationships with others and relationships that are meaningful to us. And so I think we should all care about those relationships in our lives.
I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. Our guest today is Dr. Mona Hsu, Associate Professor of Experimental Psychology here at Idaho State University. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us for questions and trivia on the Science Line.
KISU works hard to ensure the reliability of our FM signal, but occasionally, seasonal weather or equipment failures cause us to go off the air. Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
We want to pause for a moment to let you know that you're listening to The Science Line. I'm Scott Greaves, here with my co-host, Dr. Risa Ledbetter. We're now going to jump back into our conversation with Associate Professor of Experimental Psychology, Dr. Mona Hsu.
So Mona, in your two-minute segment, you mentioned that one of your research interests is romantic love. And I'm curious, how did you get into researching such an interesting topic?
Yeah, so I think it's something I've always been kind of just generally interested in. But when I started grad school and tried to narrow down what I was going to study, one of the things that really struck me was the arguments in the literature on what love looks like, especially cross-culturally. So the idea that those in individualistic Western cultures like the U.S., love is, you know, a really positive thing. It's a euphoric experience. It's jumping up and down on Oprah's couch, right? That kind of experience. And I know I'm dating myself a little bit with that reference. Whereas we see in a lot of self-report data that countries that are more collectivistic, like China, Japan, you see a more subdued response. You see more reporting of things like sacrifice and negative aspects. And for some people, they concluded that this means love is a very different experience by culture. Whereas other fields, anthropology, sociology, highlights to us that, you know, it's found in every culture pretty much across the world. So there should be some universality as well. So that's one of the big questions that really kind of got me into it. Mm-hmm. And I think the crux of the issue is when you ask people and then you see this difference by culture, you can't really tease apart, is it the actual experience is different and people are reporting that accurately? Or is it really similar, but culture is influencing the way they talk about it, or even how comfortable they are being asked about it, right? If you grew up in a culture where you're taking quizzes on your relationships or your love styles or whatever constantly,
yeah,
versus the first time you're being asked this research study, that's a very different context.
Yes. Yeah.
It's almost like if you gave two people a certain fixed level of pain and asked them to report, what is this, 0 out of 10, you might get two different answers, even though the level of pain is the exact same.
Right. And there's some cultural studies showing that for people in Eastern cultures, for example, you're less likely to use the anchors on those scales. You don't want to use the, you know, the 0 or the 10. You want to be in the middle. So there's even some of that in terms of just general reporting that might be cultural.
Have you just asked them, how do you define love, like across different cultures? And what, how do you find that that definition is the same or different?
So we haven't asked people necessarily to define love for us, but we have asked them to write about the last time they fell in love.
Okay.
And then we code the narratives. And so I've done this work in the U.S., in China, and in Iran with collaborators. And one of the takeaways is that you do see cultural differences, but you see a lot more similarities.
Okay.
And where you see similarities especially is when you look, for example, within the U.S., you can look at European Americans and Asian Americans, and they're much more similar than European Americans versus Chinese people. So there is some potential acculturation that happens in terms of how we talk about that experience.
Okay.
That's really interesting. So my next question, I think, is a really easy one. Is love real? Or is it a human social construct that manifests for a very short time to promote social utility?
Let me ask you a question. What do you mean by real?
Well, I mean, is it something that we experience that is part of our biology and manifests because it has a purpose, because it wants us to have a family construct and it's very useful in raising a child?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it actually something more spiritual?
So there's a lot in there. There are theories like evolutionary theory that points to one utility of falling in love is it focuses your attention on one person, you stay together for a while, that your children will have a better chance of survival. But, you know, if you're thinking about it, as if that's the only thing love is, then you're suggesting, for example, people who don't have kids can't fall in love. Or once your kids are out of the nest, you no longer are able to love each other. And I don't think that's true. It is a very subjective experience, though. If you're thinking about biology, so one of the series of studies I've done has been looking at romantic love with neuroimaging. And that's partly to get at, for example, the cross-cultural question, let's bypass self-report. What does it look like in the brain? And it looks very similar universally. And others have done this work too. So it looks similar universally in terms of culture, in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality.
So Mona, are you showing them pictures or giving them examples and seeing which parts of the brain are lighting up under these circumstances? Oh, those studies are so cool.
They're a lot of fun to run. I will say it's one of the interesting things is people put a huge amount of emphasis on this biological aspect. So I've had participants after the scan come up to me and say, okay, did that prove that I was in love?
Like, did I pass?
Yeah. And it's like, no, this is still at the end of the day, you decide, right? I'm just saying, you're saying you're in love. What does that look like then? And does that look similar across people?
That would probably scare a lot of people if you could go for a love test.
Right.
You could go with your partner and be like, right, it's time for us to test if we're in love.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the lie detector test of love.
Yeah. Like, that would be really scary.
We're nowhere near that accuracy yet.
Okay. So people can't be too scared.
Yep.
But to answer your question about the methodology, so there have been some pilots in terms of what to show people in the scanner. Do you show images of things or clips of letters?
Right.
But what is typical is you show an image of the person that is the beloved and then a control person. So someone you've known as long as that person, you're familiar with them, same sex, same age, etc. But you don't have those special feelings for. And so what we're looking for is what additional activation is happening when you're looking at this person you have these schmoopy feelings for compared to, you know, an acquaintance or a friend.
Mm.
Wow, that is so, so cool.
Yeah,
I think it'd
cool.
be fun to be involved in a study like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
To be honest. Yeah, that's really, really neat. So you mentioned that your lab is called the Thor Lab and that your students sometimes call you Dr. X, and what an awesome combination this is. And so your Thor Lab name stands for Teaching Health and Optimal Relationships. But maybe what are some of your favorite projects that are going on in your lab right now?
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite projects are always the ones that my students are running because, you know, they're the future and they're awesome. And
no wonder she's Teacher of the Year.
Statements like that win you awards.
That's right. That's right. It's true that, I mean, my job is to become an obsolete monster and for them to go out and, you know, science is iterative, right? We learn more and more, and what we think we know now is going to get replaced, and what I think I know is going to be disproved. And in the best world, in the luckiest world, it's going to be my students who disprove me. Hopefully they'll do so nicely. But even if they don't, that's a career that's worth having. So anyway, the two projects that are going on that I'll highlight, Ava Mosafari is doing her dissertation on the associations between interpersonal trauma, attachment, and romantic relationship conflict. Mm-hmm. So she's finishing collecting data on that. And then Mackenzie Peterson is collecting her thesis data. And I won't go into this one very much because she's collecting, so I don't want to share too much information on it. But she's looking at social comparison on Facebook. So when we look at posts by other people who are in relationships on Facebook, how that affects us depending on how we're viewing those comparisons. Mm-hmm. Like, is this couple doing really well? Are they fighting? And how that affects us as a viewer.
Wow.
Oh, that is really interesting.
That's really cool.
So when I was reading through your list of publications, there were so many interesting topics, and it was really hard to choose what my last question was going to be. But one paper you collaborated on in 2016 really caught my eye. It was a study where you suggested that investigations of romance and substance abuse are actually quite closely related and can help inform each other. So I wondered, how does that work? And in the paper you say, is love a natural addiction?
Yeah, so that came about in part because of these neuroimaging studies that I've done and many other people have done showing that, you know, what's activated are the reward regions that also activate for substances of abuse. And I don't think we should start labeling love as an addiction and treating it that way. But it's a useful kind of metaphor to think about, because for some people it really is something that, you know, you have withdrawal from, or can be problematic if you are in love with someone and it's not requited, or you don't want to be in love with them. But at the same time, there's some positive things that are happening. So a lot of people really like the idea of feeling euphoric thinking about your partner. And for some people, this lasts for decades, right? And that's something that we can try to harness in terms of, okay, what are the people who still feel really positively about their partners many years down the line? What are they doing differently? Or what are things that we can incorporate into advice for others? And one of the findings from this area is, you know, doing novel, exciting things with your partner. So keeping the relationship new and exciting.
Mm. Wow.
Very good.
And so, Scott, do we need to move on to trivia?
We probably do need to move on to trivia. You've been questioned for a long time. It's finally time.
Okay, I'm going to kick things off. And sticking with the topic of love, how long does it take to fall in love?
That seems like a harsh trivia question.
Well, the correct answer is it depends, but I don't think you're going to let me get away with that. So, like, from my research, I've seen everything from, you know, that day, the first meeting, okay, to decades. I would guess probably a few months, maybe.
Okay.
Somewhere in that range on average.
So, as you said, it's very subjective and can differ massively between people. But there was a study that was published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Okay. I don't know if this is like a good journal.
It's a very, very good journal.
Oh, well, so then, okay.
Now I'm going to kick myself for not remembering which study that was.
And so this study found that men think about confessing love about 97 days into a new relationship.
Okay.
Whereas women tend to take a little longer, and it's about 149 days. So you are very well within the realm of months.
Yep. Why do you think women take longer to think about confessing love than men?
I don't know. Now that you're saying that study, it rings a vague bell. That might also be a study suggesting that men not only think about it earlier, but they actually are often the ones who say it first.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Which goes against our stereotype of men being less emotional or less, you know, lovey-dovey. So my guess would be there are different ways to interpret that, including women might be choosier or women might be more hesitant to be hurt. Mm-hmm. But it could just be also cultural norms. Men are more likely to be the ones to do the proposing, for example. Mm-hmm. So
it's really interesting. Okay, so I'll go for one of my questions. So it seems that one theme of your work is exploring how people from different cultures, ethnicities, and genders experience falling in love. But my question to you is, in which country in the world is the highest percentage of its population in love?
Oh, my goodness. So, highest percentage of people reporting they're currently in love?
Exactly. Or? So, in this study, or in this survey, it's not really a study, it's a survey, they asked people to report if they felt like they were in love or not, and then they did an analysis to see in which country were the most people in love.
Gosh, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess it's going to be a Western country. I'm just going to guess the U.S.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's not. So according to this article, which was published in The Atlantic, the Philippines is actually the country in the world with the most people reporting that they're in love, with 93% of its population saying that they felt loved by somebody. And interestingly, the United States, which you guessed, is 26th on this list globally, with 81% of its population feeling loved. And my homeland, the UK, is down in 53rd place, with just 74% of people being in love. And sadly, Armenia is last, with just 29% of its people feeling loved.
Well, now we need to do more research in the Philippines to see what they're doing right.
Yeah,
what are they doing?
What's Armenia doing wrong? I wonder if that you can like correlate it with other social indicators. That'd be interesting.
It'd be interesting.
So, yeah.
Well, Scott, we've reached that time where we have to assign Mona her lines. Do you remember your line?
Oh, it was, I will try to convince people to swipe right on the science line.
You got it.
Awesome. Excellent job. And I think you did really, really well today.
It was a fun conversation.
And it was so interesting to sort of first hear about your letter to Nature on sexism and then about your research. But Risa, what do you think? How many lines should Mona get?
Well, man, I think she did so well that we should only give her 2 lines, which is the average number of times somebody falls in love in a lifetime.
I'll take that.
Yeah, that is according to the Huffington Post survey of at least of 2,000 American adults.
It might not be the best study ever, but only two
but
lines.
Only two good. Lines. That's all good.
That's amazing. That's actually the least lines ever on the science.
Didn't we give one time?
I don't think so.
I don't know. It's like one of the least.
Yeah,
notes.
You did, so you did awesome.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it and really enjoyed hearing about what you do.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Thank you for
joining us today on The Science Line. And if you are interested in being on the show, please contact us at thescienceline@isu.edu.